What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told his Russian counterpart Washington is preparing to take steps to suspend bilateral engagement with Moscow on Syria unless the violence in Aleppo is ended and a ceasefire restored. Kerry spoke Wednesday with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
While we haven't taken any of these steps, we're certainly thinking that through, and we're making preps to do that in the very near future. As you know, we have a team in Geneva, and while they're still there, we've certainly communicated to them that their presence in Geneva may not be the case for much longer.
Russia Wednesday said it was prepared to work with the U.S. on Syria and would send experts to Geneva for talks on normalizing the situation. Meanwhile, U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon joined the chorus of condemnation following Wednesday's attack on the two largest hospitals in rebel-held Aleppo. Dr. Abd Araman Alamar is part of the Syrian American Medical Association.
M10 hospital was targeted by a pumped barrel, and M2 hospital was shelling by more than 20 shells.
The president of the International Committee of the Red Cross said patients were killed in the attack, medical staff wounded. Those injured in the assault by pro-government forces in rebel-held Aleppo have little hope of getting life-saving medical care. The U.S. Wednesday strongly condemned recent remarks by former South Sudanese first vice president and rebel leader Riek Machar for a return to conflict against the government of President Salva Kiir. The U.S. State Department spokesman Kirby said the past 2.5 years of fighting in South Sudan did not resolve the underlying political disputes. He said Machar's comments indicate a lack of concern for the well-being of the South Sudanese people. He said Washington expects the country's transitional government and opposition to avoid a return to war at all costs. This is VOA News. International investigators say Malaysian airliner MH17 that crashed over eastern Ukraine in July 2014 was shot down by a Russian-made surface-to-air missile transported into the country from Russia and fired from near a village held by pro-Russian separatists. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric said Security Council Resolution 2166 demanded those responsible be held to account.
We believe that the final conclusion of the criminal investigation, together with those of the technical investigation led by the Dutch Safety Board that identified the cause of the crash, will be crucial in bringing the perpetrators to justice.
A Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman called the Dutch-led investigation biased and politically motivated. She said Moscow had offered to assist but was removed from full participation. Foreign policy analyst Professor Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver was asked if there will ever be justice in the case.
I doubt it. And that's a very sad thing, because all of those innocent people died. But the reality is that Russia is on the Security Council. It has one of the 5 veto votes. We wish in a righteous world, which we all wish for, that they would be brought to justice, but I think it's highly unlikely.
All 298 passengers aboard flight MH17 perished after it broke apart in midair on a trip from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte says a joint military exercise scheduled next week between his country and the U.S. will be the last. Mr. Duterte said Manila will honor its existing security treaties but will not take part in any South China Sea patrols with U.S. vessels in order to avoid getting dragged into a conflict with Beijing. Security analyst Carl Baker of the Pacific Forum in Hawaii said it's the latest off-the-cuff remark by the controversial leader, and it's uncertain yet what will happen.
Because what we've seen subsequent to Duterte's statement is Foreign Affairs Secretary Perfecto Yase said, well, I think this refers to no more joint patrols, which is something that Duterte had said a couple weeks back, that there would be no joint patrols beyond the territorial waters of the Philippines.
Early this month, Mr. Duterte called on the U.S. to withdraw special forces units that it deployed operating in the southern Philippines against Muslim extremists. A Rwandan academic is back in his home country after being extradited by the U.S. to stand trial for his role in the country's 1994 genocide. Leopold Munyakazi, accused of genocide, murder, crimes against humanity, and conspiracy to commit genocide. Turkey is expected to extend a state of emergency in the wake of last July's failed coup. It allows authorities to take swift action against those suspected of taking part in the attempted coup against the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. A teenage boy killed his father before going to a nearby elementary school in South Carolina Wednesday, wounding 2 children and a teacher before being arrested. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Thursday, September 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia's main opposition party denies it is in disarray after suspending one of its vice presidents.
The National Management Committee of the party sat and resolved that Dr. Kanisha Banda, vice president of politics in the United States for National Development, UPND, is suspended.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, UPND. A Liberian presidential candidate says if elected in next year's election, corrupt officials will face tougher consequences. South Sudan's government criticized Riek Machar for saying he will start a new civil war. And a Sierra Leone photojournalist talks about his experiences covering the Ebola crisis in his country.
Covering the crisis, it was hard because one was really, really frightened because anything can happen because there's a new epidemic that we don't understand, we don't know anything about.
Jonathan Bundu is a Sierra Leone photojournalist and filmmaker. A Malawian female referee shines on a male-dominated field, and a South African opera singer journeys from a village to world's great concert halls. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, has denied the party is falling apart after losing the August presidential election to incumbent President Edgar Lungu. The UPND suspended Kanisha Banda, its vice president in charge of politics, while a deputy spokesman also resigned. Charles Kakoma, the spokesman for the UPND, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the opposition party has legitimate reasons for suspending one of its vice presidents.
The National Management Committee of the party sat and resolved that Dr. Kanisha Banda, vice president of politics in the United Party for National Development, UPND, is suspended. He was issuing statements in the media in which he was telling the media that he has had discussions with the president of the Patriotic Front, the president of Zambia, and one of the things they've agreed with the president of Zambia is that he should be given police protection and help with the other support.
Is the UPND falling apart following the electoral victory of President Edgar Chagwa Lungu?
No, that is not falling apart. It is no more from our experience in Zambian politics and in generally in African politics. After a general election, there are some people that are weak in the opposition who would rather support a ruling party for benefits. Maybe they are expecting employment, they are expecting contracts and so on and so forth. So that happened. Some people fall off during a general election. And actually, we have done very well because not many people have taken that route of defecting to the ruling party. Of course, there are the people that you mentioned. That is Dr. Banda and Deputy Secretary, actually, Edwin Dufekelo. And unconfirmed the reports that the special advisor to President Hakainde Hichilema for special duties. There are so many advisors, but this one was for special duties. And he's also reported to have resigned. I have not confirmed that yet. But that is not to say that the party is collapsing or crumbling. If anything, genuine members of the party have become more resolved to continue fighting for their rights.
What do you say to critics who, in fact, are saying that Kanisha Banda was brought in to sanitize the reputation of the party and now you want to kick him out because he is friends, for that matter, with the president? What do you say to such criticisms?
Well, that is a misplaced analysis. In fact, this party is for all Zambians and for all tribes and for all regions or provinces making up Zambia. And therefore, the fact that Dr. Kanisha Banda happened to come from the Chewa-speaking tribe of Eastern Zambia does not make him a sanitizer, as people are calling it.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. one of the candidates for Liberia's 2017 presidential election, says if he's fortunate to be elected, he will make sure that there are tougher consequences for acts of corruption. Alexander Cummings of the Alternative National Congress Party says those consequences will include but not limited to legal prosecution, making sure that the guilty serve actual jail time. Cummings also says if elected, he will focus on job creation in multiple ways, including in the private sector. Cummings' party was one of 12 opposition political parties that earlier this month agreed to collaborate under one umbrella for the purpose of defeating the ruling Unity Party. Cummings tells me he's running for president because it is the most impactful way that he can give back to his country.
I believe I've been very blessed in life. One of those blessings is being a Liberian, very, very proudly so. And because of all the experiences I've gained over my lifetime, the organizations I've gotten to run, the countries I've gotten to live in, I feel an intense obligation, James, to give back to Liberian people. And the most impactful way to do that is through the presidency. And so I'm inspired, I've prayed about it, I've thought about it, but I'm inspired to go home and serve. And we like to do it through that office.
Mr. Cummings, how do you answer to some Liberians in Liberia who have argued that those of us in the diaspora, that every time there's an election, we come running home to run for office, although we haven't lived in Liberia permanently for many years?
Well, I would say the following. One is I have been in and out of Liberia for many, many, many years. And although I had an international career that took me out of the country, I've invested in Liberia, I've supported Liberia and Liberians. So the fact that there wasn't sort of permanent physical presence does not mean that Liberia was not always my residence.
Your party is one of 12 or more political parties that earlier this month agreed to collaborate to defeat the ruling Unity Party in the 2017 presidential election. How is that collaboration working out?
Well, I would say the coalition or collaboration is in its infancy. We signed this declaration literally only 2 weeks ago. And in any situation where you're bringing competitors, if I may use that word, together, you are going to have some challenges along the way. And so I don't believe we should prematurely give up on the objectives. We will have bumps along the way. And if you read the declarations, the things we committed to are all things we should be prepared to abide by.
If you were elected, what would you do to improve the economy?
Well, several things I would say. One, we would be very focused on job creation. You mentioned 80% unemployment. And you create jobs in multiple ways. One, we got to find ways to grow the private sector. There is overdependence on the government in our country, but we got to diversify the economy. We got to make sure we're extracting more value from our natural resources.
I spoke with Senator Prince Johnson, the architect of this collaboration we've been talking about now, and one of the accusations he leveled against Vice President Joseph Boakai, who is also running to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is that President Sirleaf has failed to fight corruption. Say you were elected president, how would you deal with the issue of corruption in Liberia?
Well, first of all, it's about acknowledging the fact that corruption is very endemic, unfortunately, endemic in our society, and that we all play a role, big and small, in this thing called corruption. But the first thing we'll need to do is make sure there are consequences to anybody who's corrupt, big or small, but particularly, quote-unquote, big people, because they should know better, they should set the example, and when they are corrupt, the consequences is significantly more dire.
When you talk about consequences, you talk about legal punitive action?
I'm talking about exactly legal consequences. So it's not just, you know, terminating somebody or firing somebody, but it's also prosecuting people. Because if you just terminate an individual, right, they walk away with the funds. I mean, that's not a consequence in my mind.
Alexander Cummings is the presidential candidate of the Alternative National Congress Party of Liberia. You are speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Thursday, September 29th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. In South Sudan, Some ruling SPLM party officials are reiterating their commitment to implement the August 2015 peace agreement, while also denouncing any attempts to return to war. A senior member of the SPLM says South Sudanese should use peaceful means to change the country's leadership. He criticized former First Vice President Riek Machar and his supporters for organizing an armed resistance against President Salva Kiir's government. Michael Atit reports from Juba.
SPLM spokesman Bol Makweng Yol warns returning to violence will only cause more death and destruction. He accuses Riek Machar and former Agriculture and Food Security Minister Lam Akol of mobilizing young people against the government.
They are for the destruction of the country, destruction of people, encouraging hatred among people of South Sudan. And that we don't want it as SPLM, because all these people, ourselves, will go and the next generation will come.
Early this week, Akol announced he had formed a new rebel group called the National Democratic Movement, whose goal was to overthrow the government in Juba. Over the weekend, Machar's SPLM Ayo issued a statement declaring war against Mr. Kiir's leadership, saying the 2015 peace agreement had collapsed. Makweng is calling on the South Sudanese youth to reject Machar's call for armed resistance against the Kiir administration.
They are misleading our most able young leaders of our country by telling them that we'll give you stars, you will be captains, you will be generals. We have a procedure for that.
Machar's group announced the resumption of war after meeting with top members of his party in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Makweng is urging regional and international communities, including Sudan, not to interfere with South Sudan internal affairs.
We are capable of being stable without interference, because they cannot agitate us to kill ourselves. We have experienced the destructive wars through interventions from many different countries in the Middle East and in Africa. But South Sudan is now stable.
Peter Aduok Nyaba, the former Minister of Higher Education and a senior SPLM IO member, blames President Kiir for the flare-up violence across Juba 2 months ago.
The war was declared by Salva Kiir himself on the 10th of July when he ordered the attack on our positions in Jebel Kujur. The war has not ended. He has been pursuing us, you know, attacking us with all kinds of gunships, drones, and spy planes.
Nyaba says President Kiir caused the collapse of the peace agreement by attacking Machar's forces in July.
People of South Sudan know who is really the problem for the people of South Sudan. It is Salva and the Gen Council of Elders who have now decided to declare war on all the ethnic communities of South Sudan.
The July fighting in Juba forced the former first vice president to escape on foot to the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, where the United Nations helped transport Machar and hundreds of his fighters to safe location in DRC. Machar and his few fighters were then transported to Sudan on humanitarian grounds. Sudan authorities say Machar will travel to a country of his choice at a later date after completing his treatment. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
A Sierra Leone photojournalist and filmmaker who covered the Ebola crisis in his country says being extra careful after a day's work was one of the ways he tried to protect himself and his family from contracting the disease. Jonathan Bundu is in the United States, where his work was displayed at the Photoville Festival organized by the Open Society Foundation in New York. Bundu says he did the job not just as a photojournalist, but because maybe God wanted him to be there to cover the crisis from the Sierra Leone perspective.
It was not really easy at the start of the crisis, because when I started documenting the crisis, I happened to go to Moyamba, which is the south, wherein I met 12 people at the holding center, and I was there till all of them were buried, and I have to photograph them. And also, I saw that the 1 acre or more land that was given by the chief to bury people was actually used up because there were so many deaths by that time. So it was not easy. One was really, really frightened, because anything can happen, because there's a new epidemic that we don't understand, we don't know anything about, because even medical practitioners were losing their life, nurses were dying, and doctors were dying. Yes.
So I'm asking, why did you do it?
That's the question people keep asking, and I keep asking myself, what was happening? But maybe God wants me to be there and tell the story from a civilian perspective, somebody whose country has been hit by the Ebola crisis, because taking those photos, going into those pits, seeing those safe and dignified burials that were not happening before, it was not easy. Because at first, when we started the Ebola crisis, people were buried like dogs. They would go there, drop them into vehicles, and they would whisk off because there was no ceremony. But it got to a point where aid agencies come together and say, look, we have to give our people a safe and dignified burial. If it's a Muslim, they will say a Muslim prayer. If it's a Christian, they will say a Christian prayer. And then families can actually, if you want to give something like a cloth or a lapa or wrapper, your family can go with, so that dignity, sending the disease back home in a dignified way, was really easy. And also what I marvel at was the resilience of the women, the survivors, those women who survived Ebola, who came back and started actually working with the burial team, because at first it was men burying women, which to our culture is not right, because for a man to see a naked part of a woman, who is not, so it's not correct. Yeah.
So when you go home, you see, you come from covering the Ebola crisis. How did you protect yourself and the family from attracting the virus?
It was really hard. But what I did was, if I get home, was to like actually stay outside and disinfect myself, like take off my boots, take off my clothes, take off everything, and right away those ones would be sanitized before, and it won't even get into the house. They've been washed, and I have to wash with Dettol every day. And when it gets to the point, like in November, where you have so many deaths, like over 200 deaths every day in November, I got really scared. So sometimes when I come back, I'll stay far away and then disinfect myself and then not let my children even come close, because I am not sure what will happen at the end of the day.
Now you are in the United States. What brings you here?
I'm here because of the Photoville Festival, because Ebola Food Lens is premiered to the Photoville. There's a festival of photojournalists that come together and exhibit their work. And so part of Photoville this year was Ebola Food Lens, which was done by Open Society Foundations.
Jonathan Bundu is a Sierra Leone photojournalist and a filmmaker. He was speaking with me in our Washington studio. In Malawi, a female football referee has been blazing the grounds, officiating a major international contest. Her assignments have included this year's Summer Olympics in Rio and the FIFA Women's World Cup. Lamek Masina has her story.
Benedict Quimbilanzika's passion for refereeing started when she joined the Malawian army as a soldier 16 years ago. As a soldier, she used to attend football matches.
At that time, the only thing I knew about football was the offside thing. So when the assistant referee raises a flag and then there's this referee who puts his arm up, whistle, point the other direction. So I was so much interested with what the referees were doing.
A mother of two who now works as a secretary in the University of Malawi had to attend a refereeing course for beginners where she earned a grade 3 refereeing certificate. She has now been officiating matches for 14 years and she has risen to the top of her field at both local and international levels. This year, Quimbilanzika became the first Malawian female referee to officiate at the Olympics. Last year, she became the first Malawian to referee at the FIFA Women's World Cup held in Canada. Also, last year, she was voted the best assistant referee for Malawi's top-level Super League. In 2013, Quimbilanzika scooped up the best referee accolade for the Confederation of African Football Elite A referees course for males and females held in Egypt.
Of course, I wanted to get far with Football Association, but to be honest with you, there was not even a single day I imagined myself officiating at the world's biggest football event like the World Cup, the Olympics.
She owes her success to the adherence to the rules of the game.
As a good referee, you don't have to pretend that you haven't seen something when you have clearly seen it, or to make your own rules. Where it requires a yellow card, you have to caution that player. Where it requires a send-off, you have to show that player a red card.
She says being a female football referee in a country where soccer officiating is dominated by men, she endures insult from soccer fans every time she steps on the field of play. She says some people tell her to officiate netball, one of the most popular women's sports in Malawi. She expects this, however, and says, "I do not give it a damn." Madaliso Pili is a sports editor at privately owned Capital Radio. He says he has long following Kwimbila Senzika's style of officiating.
I can't remember any games that have ended in any kind of controversy, be it violence or that the teams were not happy with some of the decisions she made. So it speaks volume that this lady knows what she does.
Kwimbila Senzika, who is 35 years old, says it is her wish to maintain her reputation as a good referee until she retires, probably in 5 years' time. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Zomba.
She has performed for heads of state and at royal weddings around the world, impressed audiences at some of the great concert halls. But Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg, Zandile Mzazi remains virtually unknown in her home country, South Africa.
The sound of 32-year-old Zandile Mzazi from the tiny rural town of Elliot in South Africa's Eastern Cape province. She's petite and soft-spoken, but Mzazi says she's on this earth to make a noise.
My mom said when I was born, the first day, I cried so much. She said, my gosh, those lungs, the nurses from the entire floor of the hospital, they came because they thought maybe we were slaughtering this child, you know.
As a girl, she and friends would stage their own talent competitions.
I always thought I was going to be a pop singer because I always loved music. I've always loved imitating singers, Whitney Houston, you know, and I was good at it, hey.
But Mzazi's family's musical interests stretched further than just pop hits.
Opera music was not something that I knew or familiar with. However, I knew about oratorio music because my aunt used to play a lot of Messiah, you know, from Handel. So I grew up listening to the Messiah.
After winning several national singing competitions, the University of Cape Town offered her a scholarship to study music. Mzazi says she's attracted to the sadness and drama of opera.
I can't say I've got a big voice. My tone is a little bit dark.
But her soprano voice has taken her to the great concert halls of the world, Rome, Vienna, London, New York, where she's performed classic opera pieces.
Whenever I perform and I hear my sound, it shocks me because it is really incredible that I'm so blessed with this instrument.
One of the world's legendary opera singers, Montserrat Cabal, selected her to perform in Italy last year. She doesn't spend much time in South Africa, but one of her most memorable performances was at last year's Summit on Cooperation between Africa and China in Johannesburg. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. The United States Wednesday imposed sanctions on two close aides to Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila for undermining democracy and violently suppressing free speech and human rights. That's it for this Thursday, September 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Zubair El Tayeb, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good Thursday.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar has called for an armed struggle against the government of President Salva Kiir, a move that could mark a renewal of the country's civil war. We'll discuss the new developments in South Sudan next on Straight Talk Africa. at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.